नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So reading today from the 6th canto, 14th chapter entitled King Chitraketu's Lamentation. We'll begin with text 56 and continue through the end of the chapter. So today's verse is too long to put on the board. Krishna Pad just couldn't squeeze it on there. It's text 56. So I'll read it myself, go through the synonyms and translation and purport, and then read through the rest of the chapter, which is just without purports. Tam tatta narasi chamam kripanam anatam tatum vichakshva pitaram tavashoka taptam agastarema bhavatar Praja dushtaram yad dvantam ya dvantam na yahya krurena yamena duram. Synonyms. Twam, you. Tata, my dear son. Na, not. Arhasi, at. Cha, and. Mam, me. Kripanam, very poor. Anatam, without a protector. Tyaktum, to give up. Vichakshva, look. Pitaram, and the father. Tava, your. Shoka taptam, affected by so much lamentation. Agya, easily. Tarema, we can cross. Bhavata, by you. Aprajadushtaram, very difficult to cross for one without a son. Yat, which. Dvantam, the kingdom of darkness. Nayahi, do not go away. Akrurena, merciless. Yamena, with Yamaraj. Duram, any further. Translation and purport, by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. My dear son, I am helpless and very much aggrieved. You should not give up my company. Just look at your lamenting father. We are helpless because without a son, we shall have to suffer the distress of going to the darkest, hellish regions. You are the only hope by which we can get out of these dark regions. Therefore, I request you not to go any further with the merciless Yama. Purport. According to the Vedic injunctions, one must accept a wife just to beget a son who can deliver one from the clutches of Yamaraj. Unless one has a son to offer oblations to the Pitas, or forefathers, one must suffer in Yamaraj's kingdom. King Chitraketu was very much aggrieved, thinking that because his son was going away with Yamaraj, he himself would again suffer. The subtle laws exist for the Karmis. If one becomes a devotee, he has no more obligations to the laws of karma. Next text. My dear son, you have slept a long time. Now please get up. Your playmates are calling you to play. Since you must be very hungry, please get up and suck my breast and dissipate our lamentation. My dear son, I am certainly most unfortunate, for I can no longer see your mild smiling. You have closed your eyes forever. I therefore conclude that you have been taken from this planet to another, from which you will not return. My dear son, I can no longer hear your pleasing voice. Srila Shukadeva Goswami continued, accompanied by his wife, who was thus lamenting for her dead son, King Chitraketu began crying loudly, with an open mouth, being greatly aggrieved. As the king and queen lamented, all their male and female followers joined them in crying. Because of the sudden accident, all the citizens of the kingdom were almost unconscious. When the great sage Angira understood that the king was almost dead in an ocean of lamentation, he went there with Narada Rishi. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 6th canto, 14th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled King Chitraketu's Lamentation. Om Agyane Timurandasya Ganandana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitangena Tasmaya Shri Guruve Namaha Namaham Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Paladananda Swami Tone Namaham Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tone Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Bhacharne Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschyati Ati Shitarne. So first of all, I'd like to thank everyone for being here in class. It's always an honor to have some Vaishnavas to serve. I wasn't scheduled originally to give the class today, but the person who I had scheduled told me yesterday that he wouldn't be able to give the class. So please forgive me. So it's really interesting here. I find that even though King Chitraketu and his wives, they are very well educated. They are very knowledgeable of things that we don't really take so much for granted here, you know, in modern times. You know, here his King Chitraketu's wife is talking about reincarnation, talking about how their son is now on a different planet, which in modern times these different concepts are practically unheard of. You know, when somebody dies, they just think, oh, well, he's just dead and gone. Or they think, well, she's laying in the cemetery. You know, like when people go visit their departed loved ones, they go to the cemetery and then talk to the gravestones thinking that my dearly beloved is here, buried 6 feet under in the ground. In fact, in one branch of Christianity, they even believed that if there is any defects of the body, such as an arm missing or some terrible disfiguration, then they would try to fix that on the dead body before the body was buried, because they believed that when Christ came for the second time, that all the bodies would be resurrected, and then those bodies would be going to heaven. So if you were missing a limb, then when you go to heaven, you'd be missing a limb too. If you're some cripple, some quadriplegic in a wheelchair, you'd be a quadriplegic in heaven also. It's a really crude understanding of transcendence, very primitive. So that's why to this day in the Western countries people spend countless thousands and thousands of dollars on making bodies look appealing before they're buried, even though they don't really know exactly why they feel compelled to do so. It's just become such a deeply enrooted custom. So we can see how strongly the modes of material nature affect us. Oftentimes people in the modes of passion and ignorance have a very rosy view of the mode of goodness, thinking, oh, the mode of goodness is so glorious, you're practically liberated if you're in the mode of goodness. But we can see here that even people, you know, very pious, very educated, very much in the mode of goodness, and yet we can see through this particular pastime how binding even being in the mode of goodness is. You know, King Chitraketu was such a benevolent king, so pious, did everything very properly. And yet he's so concerned about where he will be in his next life. But not concerned in terms of transcendence, in terms of liberation. Rather concerned, what will my next birth be? Because these modes of material nature always bind us. They always entrap us, lifetime after lifetime in this material world. And we get so caught up in the whole illusion that what's happening here in this material world is actually of any significance, that we forget about what the real purpose of life is. Like King Chitraketu and his wife, they're so caught up in the distress of not being able to have a son. Why? Because their son was their fire insurance. They didn't want to burn and suffer in their next life by going down to hell. Just like so many people of different religions nowadays, that's how they view religion. They just view it as fire insurance. They're not interested because they're actually interested in God, actually interested in developing some wonderful loving relationship and reciprocation with Krishna. They're just interested because they just want to save their own butt. They're just concerned about their own bodily well-being. How can I minimize my suffering? I remember being out distributing books. So many times I'd run into people of different religions, and they would ask me, you know, why I was practicing this. Then they would try to convince me of why I should practice, you know, their particular line of belief. And they would say, well, what's the worst case scenario? You should survey all the religions and then find out which one has the worst bad scenario. And then believe in that religion. I said, well, that's kind of foolish. You know, why would you do that? They said, well, because if it's true, then you're saved from the worst suffering. And I said, okay, but what do I care about the suffering? You know, what about, you know, love? What about loving God? They said, well, that doesn't matter. You know, what really matters is avoiding the worst kinds of suffering and pain possible. And then whichever religion has that, whichever religion promises the most amount of suffering, that one you should follow. And I'm just thinking, my God, these people are crazy. But, you know, that's the factual reality. Everyone's so deeply entrenched in this bodily concept of life, thinking, how can I maximize my enjoyment? How can I minimize my suffering? So that even when people are educated with a little bit of Vedic knowledge, and as we can see, most of the greatest, most powerful demons were actually highly educated in these Vedic sciences. Like Kamsa, he gave perfect, you know, eloquent discourses on the laws of material nature and how things must progress, but yet he came to the wrong conclusion. Or Hiranyakashipu, full knowledge of the Vedas, but because of their demonic mentality, they twist the ultimate conclusion, the ultimate understanding of the Vedas, to mean something very different. Because they're not interested in what the actual ultimate goal of life is. They're just interested in how can I maximize my enjoyment and how can I minimize my suffering. And so they completely lose sight of the ultimate purpose of life, and they become completely focused on simply manipulating their karma for their own benefit, which in reality is simply karma mimamsa of philosophy. The belief that by manipulating my activities right now, I will be able to enjoy more later and suffer less later. But in modern society, we're not even that advanced. We're not even advanced enough to be interested in the results of our own activities. Rather, people are so short-sighted that they're simply interested in what will make me feel good now. I saw one rather interesting, I suppose, or disturbing article the other day that was saying that 1 in every 10 Americans is on antidepressant drugs. Now that's pretty significant. So that means that out of, assuming that all of you are regular materialistic people, that would mean that 1 out of, that in this room you would have 10. Yeah, we'd have about 3 people on antidepressant drugs, just in this room. And then the population between ages 12 to 30, it's even more mind-boggling. I think it, can't remember exactly, but it was something like 1 in 3. Just an incredible number of young people nowadays. Because they're just interested in what's immediately beneficial. And then also their parents, when they're not young enough yet to decide for themselves, they're just interested in what will make me happy now. Rather than trying to figure out what the real solutions to things are, people are just given pills just as like candy, just to make them feel better now. Even though they have, you know, issues that they may need to work through. But they'd rather not address that. They'd rather just get back to the enjoyment. You know, granted, in some situations it may be necessary to, you know, use different things like that, but in modern times, it's often overprescribed. So that's why it's so important to really understand what the real purpose of life is. Krishna nicely sums it up in one verse from the Bhagavad Gita, 1864. Krishna says, Sarva guyattamam bhuyak shrinu me paramam vachaha ishto si me dridamiti tato vakshyami te hitam. Because you are my very dear friend, I am speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. Hear this from me, for it is for your benefit. So, this right here is the ultimate purpose of life. It's very significant that Krishna says, because you are my very dear friend. That's a very, very significant point that Krishna's making. Another significant point, Krishna is saying, hear this from me. In other words, how can we realize what the ultimate purpose of life is? How can we realize that all these different travails in this material world are, in a sense, a meaningless waste of time? How can we actually understand that? How can we come to the point of realization that all these different tribulations, all these different trials, all this suffering, all this effort, it's all misapplied if it's applied outside of Krishna? Just like King Chitraketu. It was all a misapplied effort. He was so wrapped up in the bodily concept of life, thinking If I don't have a son, I'm going to suffer in hell. So his whole motivation is not to suffer, thinking about his own bodily comfort. And so because of this fear of his, this fear of suffering, he undergoes even more suffering. That's the nature of the material world. It's just like an itch. Once you scratch the itch actually burns worse. I don't know if any of you have ever had poison oak or poison ivy. Poison ivy is actually a lot worse. I have. Very painful. So with poison ivy, it may start with a small patch. What it actually is, it's these different oils. It's called urushiols, and they chemically bind to the skin. And so even if you wash with soap, it doesn't come off because they actually bind so tightly to the skin. And it's like such a caustic substance that your body tries to get it away from the skin, which causes these, blisters. It, raises up from the skin. And then any liquids or any time you touch it or clothes brushed by it, it spreads that oil to other parts of your body. And so because the burning and itching is so severe, you try scratching it. And temporarily it brings great relief. You feel, oh wow, this feels so good. But then as soon as you stop itching, immediately it inflames 10 times worse. And because you itched it, now it's on your fingers, and now it spreads to the whole area that you were scratching. And then even if you wash your hands, it doesn't matter. Then if you touch that hand that you used to scratch, and you touch anywhere else in your body, you'll have it there also. It's rather an ingenious little torture device created by the material energy. And it's the same way with these attachments, with how this material energy works. It causes a little bit of an itching sensation. And so you go to scratch it a little bit, and then you get contaminated. Every time you interact with this material energy, you get more and more contaminated. And then every other place you touch, that place also gets contaminated. That place also starts burning and itching. And then the more you itch it, the more it burns. And the more it burns, the more you have to itch it. It's really quite terrible. And especially with poison ivy, which is, like the terrible older brother of poison oak, it doesn't just go away so easily. A few years ago, one time I got it when I was in Kansas. And, I was on traveling sankirtan, and we drove all the way out to Florida doing Warped Tour concerts all along the way. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Another time I had it when I was went up to Minnesota, and we did a trip to New York after that. And it just kept getting worse. And the doctors that I went to were just idiots prescribing antibiotics for it, when it's actually not a biotic agent in the body at all. It's just oil. It's oil on the skin. And, so a month goes by and it's still getting worse. A month and a half goes by and I'm thinking, I got to go to the doctor. So finally they have to give me steroids. So that's the nature of this material world. It's so virulent. The infection is so persistent that unless we get help from a qualified professional, we won't be able to get free from this terrible itching sensation. So who is this qualified professional? Krishna is saying here, hear this from me. Krishna is a qualified professional. Krishna's associates are qualified professionals. Krishna's devotees are qualified professionals. Hearing is such an important aspect of Krishna consciousness, of getting free from the clutches of this material energy. That actually, in the verse that Prabhupada talks about most from the Bhagavad Gita, verse 7-1, Krishna is saying, Tatrinu, just hear from me. This is most important. This is the most essential aspect of Krishna consciousness, hearing. If we can't properly hear, we'll have an extremely difficult time struggling with these material modes of nature. So Prabhupada explains many times that when you go see a doctor, when you see a qualified professional, and you're diseased, you're in a diseased condition, they give you medicine, and they give you a diet, and they give you instructions on how to properly take your medicine. What you need to eat, when you need to sleep. And then if some well-meaning friend comes by and says, oh, I brought you your favorite food. But not knowing that that food will actually cause their demise. So that's actually why we have to hear from the qualified professional. So if you're sick, you have to hear what the doctor says. Take 2 pills 4 times a day on an empty stomach, fast half day, whatever. And then follow those instructions. Just like when we're fed up, when we're frustrated with the disease, as Prabhupada called it, the skin disease, the disease of this material world, identifying with this material body, then we have to seek the help of a qualified professional. We have to seek the help of a devotee. Or in this case, with Arjuna, we have to seek the help of Krishna. Just like King Chitraketu, unknowingly, he's seeking the help of... what was the sage that came? Angira Muni. He's unknowingly seeking Angira's help. He was originally seeking Angira Muni's help to, you know, save him from hell. But actually, Angira Rishi has a much greater plan in store for him. Because Angira Rishi could see that he was actually qualified, he was primed and ready for higher transcendental understanding. He just needed a little bit more experience about the nature of this material world, how this material energy works, before he would be ripe for transcendence. So that's why we have to hear from the qualified professional about the ultimate goal of life, which, as Krishna says in this Gita verse, is to become his very dear friend. By becoming Krishna's very dear friend, the most supreme instruction, the most confidential of all knowledge, Krishna will directly impart to us through our heart. He will give us ultimate understanding of actually what we need to do, where we need to go, what the purpose of this existence is, so we won't have to waste all of our valuable time and energy. So, today is also the appearance day of Srila Virabhadra Goswami. There's not a whole lot of information about him in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but in the Adi Lila 11th chapter, text 8, describing the tree of Lord Chaitanya, it does mention Virabhadra Goswami. He is mentioned much more in the Bhakti Ratnakar, which Prabhupada does quote within his own books. I would have actually read some passages from the Bhakti Ratnakar, but I didn't have time to collect them. So I'll just read the translation and then the purport from this text, Adi 11.8. After Nityananda Prabhu, the greatest branch is Veerabhadra Gosani, who also has innumerable branches and sub-branches. It's not possible to describe them all. Purport. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes in his Anubhashya, Veerabhadra Gosani was the direct son of Srila Nityananda Prabhu and a disciple of Janava Devi. His real mother was Vasudha, and the Gaura Ganadesh Deepika, he is mentioned as an incarnation of Kshirdakshaya Vishnu. Therefore, Veerabhadra Gosani is non-different from Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In a village of the name Jamatapura, in the district of Hooghly, Veerabhadra Gosani had a disciple named Yadunathacharya, who had two daughters, a real daughter named Srimati, and a foster daughter named Narayani. Both these daughters married, and they are mentioned in the Bhakti Ratnakara, 13th wave. Veerabhadra Gosani had three disciples who were celebrated as his sons, Gopijanavallabha, Ramakrishna, and Ramachandra. The youngest, Ramachandra, belonged to the Shandilya dynasty and had the surname Vatavyala. He established his family in Karadara, and its members are known as the Goswamis of Karadara. Karadaha. The eldest disciple, Gopijanavallabha, was a resident of a village known as Lata, near the Manakara railway station in the district of Burdwan. The second, Ramakrishna, lived near Maladaha, in a village named Gayeshapur. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur notes that since these three disciples belonged to different gotras or dynasties, they also had different surnames and lived in different places. It's not possible to accept them as real sons of Veerabhadra Gosani. Ramchandra had four sons, of whom the eldest was Radhamadava, whose third son was named Yadavindra. Yadavindra's son was Nanda Kishore, and his son was Nanda Krishna. His son was Chaitanya Chandra. His son was Krishna Mohan. His son was Jagan Mohan, and his son was Rajanata. And his son was Shyamalala Goswami. This is the genealogical table given by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur for the descendants of Veerabhadra Gosani. And then the next text concludes. Although Veerabhadra Gosani was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he presented himself as a great devotee. And although the Supreme Godhead is transcendental to all Vedic injunctions, he strictly followed the Vedic rituals. So I'll end there if there's any comments or questions. Yes, Lord Karuna?
Isn't it also the responsibility of a king to have a son because someone to help to take care of his praja, his, you know. I mean, I'm playing the devil's advocate because actually I know he was all attached and he was not on the spiritual path. But on the other hand, it is a little different when a king wants to have a son than an ordinary person.
Well, yes and no. Yes, it is the duty of a king to have a son to carry on the kingdom. However, that's still material, and that's not the ultimate goal of life. And also, we know that that wasn't his main motivation either, because in this whole chapter, King Chitraketu, and previous chapter in this whole pastime of King Chitraketu, it's revealed that King Chitraketu he actually never even mentioned that. His main concern was, I need a son so we won't go to hell. Yeah.
If he doesn't take care of his duty of taking care of the kingdom through his son, then that's what would be sending him to hell. You see, because it's like, I mean,
well, any person who's not a devotee, who doesn't have children, they're going to go to hell. Basically speaking, I mean, that's why it's called putra. Put is one of the hells. And tra, it's the Sanskrit root for triyate, which means to deliver. That's why children are called putra, because they deliver you from hell by performing the shraddha ceremony and offering pinda. So it doesn't matter if you're a king or not. If you're a man or a woman in this material world and you're not a devotee, you're going to go to hell if you don't have kids. I mean, that's just how it's presented.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. I just thought that in the case of a king, it's just that much more of a responsibility or a debt to the society or something.
Yeah, kings do carry more responsibility. But at the same time, kings also, you know, they get more karma, so to speak, also. Because they get 1/6 of all the reactions of everyone in their kingdom, whether it be good or bad. So if the king manages the kingdom properly, then assuming the king can make everyone pious, then the king will get tremendous pious benefit from being king. But if the king can't stamp out all impiety, then the king's going to suffer 1/6 of all the impious activities of all his kingdom. Yes?
Go to heaven. And what about our culture? If you have a daughter, but you don't have sons, what's going to be? You also going to go to hell?
If you have what, then you'll...
You don't have sons, but you have daughter.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter, son or daughter. We just need someone to offer the pinda and the shraddha ceremony. I heard from Ravindra Swarup. There was one lecture that Sri Sachi let me hear where Ravindra Swarup was actually explaining how people become Yamadutas. How when people go to Pitri Loka, they stay there on the strength of the offerings given by their descendants. That's the admission fee, so to speak, of being able to stay with Yamaraj in his court. Yamaraj is actually very handsome and he has this very opulent court. And people who are pious, they can go to Pitri Loka to enjoy there, even though Pitri Loka is in the lower planetary systems. But if their descendants stop offering oblations to the forefathers, then they start starving, because that's how they eat in Pitri Loka. So they no longer have any food. They're in Pitri Loka and they start becoming very famished. They start experiencing so much suffering and pain. And then when they become very haggard and almost mad from a lack of food, because they have a subtle body so they can't die, so to speak, they'll just suffer a lot. And so then when Yamaraj sees them suffering too much, then he offers them a position as being a Yamaduta. Their faces are already contorted and twisted from, you know, so much suffering. And from going through this experience, they have an extreme hatred of impiety. And so when they execute their functions as the agents of Yamaraj, they execute it with extreme zeal, because they have an extreme hatred for anyone who is a wrongdoer. And so with great pleasure, they rip the souls out of bodies and take them before Yamaraj. Vishnu Dutas? Devotees? No, it's just, you know, when people go to Vaikuntha, you know, you assume your natural position. Some people are Vishnu Dutas and some people are gatekeepers like Jai and Vijay and, you know, so many different things, yeah. Okay, so I'll end here. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.